getting away with it. But I really believe that, like, now with more people understanding that, I don't think
Angela
it's just a
Clara,
black
we have to leave
white.
It there, but we're going to continue the discussion in part two. People can go online at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Programming for WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. For a few special invitations printed or thousands of full-color flyers, Minuteman Press can help get it done on time and in budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Phone is 217-355-0550. They are located at 905 South Neal Street in Champaign or www.champaignprinting.com.
This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a pre-recorded interview with Ravi Malhotra and Morgan Rowe, authors of Exploring Disability Identity and Disability Rights Through Narratives, Finding a Voice of Their Own. But first, disability news for the week of January 7th, 2019. Phoenix, Arizona police are investigating possible sex abuse at a nursing facility after a female patient recently became pregnant and gave birth. Sources say the alleged victim had been a patient at the Hacienda Healthcare facility for at least a decade after a near-drowning incident left her in a persistent coma. That woman gave birth to a baby boy on December 29th. A source familiar with the situation said, quote, "None of the staff were aware that she was pregnant until she was pretty much giving birth," end quote. That source also said the patient required around-the-clock care and many would have access to her room. She said the facility has changed protocol. If a male staff needs to enter a female room, they now need to bring in a female employee with them. Dr. Greg Marchand said that even though a baby can fully develop inside a woman in a persistent coma, it's alarming that she had no prenatal care. Investigators from multiple agencies are saying next to nothing about the case. The Arizona Coalition to End Sexual and Domestic Violence spokesperson Tasha Menacher is horrified by the allegations and worries there could be more alleged victims. She said, quote, "In sexual assault cases, it's not uncommon that perpetrators have multiple victims, and so that would be a concern for us. Our hope is that there will be a thorough investigation that identifies the person who did this, and if for some reason we weren't to see a thorough investigation, we would take further steps. There's an infant involved, which is evidence, and so I think the first place to begin would be a DNA test of that child, and that's something the police department has the capacity to do. Many sex assault perpetrators are actually looking for situations where people are in isolated or vulnerable positions, and because most perpetrators are not reported to the police or their cases don't actually move forward, we always don't know if someone has a history of engaging in sexual harm against people," end quote. She also explained that people living with disabilities are three more times at risk of sexual violence than people without. Management at Rogers Plaza in Wyoming, Michigan said a 2-year-old girl with developmental disabilities is banned from the mall. Claire Dykstra and her grandfather go to the mall to walk every Thursday. It's exercise for him and practice for her. And when Claire gets tired, she sits down for a few minutes behind her custom-built baby walker. But mall management says sitting on the floor is prohibited and Claire should not come back. Explained Hillary Dykstra, the child's mother, quote, "The manager of the mall came up to them and started an argument about Claire not being able to sit on the floor. My dad tried calmly to tell him about Claire, and he said, 'That's it. You're out and don't come back.' The next step is he was going to call the cops on them," end quote. Since Claire was banned, someone took a picture of people sitting on the Rogers Plaza floor waiting for a store to open. That was apparently not objected to. The Dykstras say they will not return to Rogers Plaza, but other malls in the area told them they are welcome to come and walk. According to Andrew Dykstra, the child's father, quote, "We are just trying to find a safe place for her to practice walking. We are not looking for conflict. All we wanted is a safe place," end quote. The Sonoma Developmental Center, the oldest institution in California established specifically for people with developmental disabilities, officially closed its door last week after 127 years. The developmental center, known for generations simply as SDC, was ordered by Governor Jerry Brown in 2015 to begin a three-year closure process. SDC had at its peak been home to more than 3,000 residents. Its final clients left the campus in mid-December, according to officials at the State Department of Developmental Services. 60 years ago, SDC operated at its maximum capacity with 3,200 residents, many of them children, with a waiting list of more than 1,000. SDC's staff at one point numbered 1,300. Until about a year ago, that facility was still the largest employer in the region. The Sonoma Developmental Center has slowly downsized over the years as models of care for people with developmental disabilities grew smaller and more centrally located to community residential neighborhoods. SDC clients have been relocating steadily since 2015, when the state announced the three-year timeline to shutter the facility as part of its move toward operating a limited number of smaller safety net and crisis residential services. As of last week, the SDC property entered a warm shutdown period where budgeted money will be used to maintain the property while its facilities are vacant. The warm shutdown also provides time for legislators and the Valley community to decide on the next stage for the campus buildings and the 860-acre property. The DDS will continue to be the landlord until June 30th, when the oversight and disposition of the property will switch to the state's Department of General Services. First District Supervisor Susan Gorin has said that her constituents want to see the land dedicated to public open space. She has articulated a plan that would see the state grant the property to the county and then see it transferred to the adjacent state and regional park system. In a letter last month to SDC stakeholders, Facility Director Charlotte Jones said that, quote, "The last resident of Sonoma Developmental Center transitioned to a new home on December 17th, end quote. Most employees signed out by December 31st, though some staff will remain on campus and prepare it for its firm closure in June. And finally, recent reports show that most of the 12 million people with intellectual disabilities in the country of Iran receive little to no assistance to gain independence in their lives or protect them from abuse and violence. Services provided by the SWO, the country's main agency tasked with providing services to people, instead include offering severely inadequate financial assistance to a limited number of families while focusing on disability prevention, which is not in its mandate. The mother of a 16-year-old girl with Down syndrome told the Center for Human Rights in Iran, the CHRI, that the SWO provides inadequate financial and social support, leaving families to fend for themselves. People who spoke to CHRI for this report did so on the condition of anonymity for fear of reprisals by security forces and Iran's judiciary for speaking to a foreign organization. Meanwhile, most people in Iran do not even know the difference between intellectual and psychological disability. The Iranian government has also failed to differentiate between the two groups. Failing to do so not only results in the spread of misinformation in society, including harmful stereotypes and stigmatization, it also leads to state agencies providing inadequate support and services that are necessary for people affected by these disabilities to live fulfilling lives. And that's the news for this week.
These words.
And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I'm joined today by two guests on the phone, authors Ravi Malhotra and Morgan Rowe, who wrote a book called Exploring Disability Identity and Disability Rights Through Narratives, Finding a Voice of Their Own. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Great. Well, why don't we start with a little introduction of both of you? Just tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, and then we'll delve into the work that you've done and continue to do. Ravi, why don't you go first?
Okay, so I've been a disability rights advocate for a number of years in Canada, where I teach at the University of Ottawa. I'm a lawyer by training, so I teach law, and I've served on the Human Rights Committee of the Council of Canadians with Disabilities, which is our leading cross-disability organization, for a number of years, and we work on test case litigation. And I've worked on a number of issues, but I think that sort of gives you a broad overview. I teach disability rights law to first-year students, and I also teach human rights.
And I think that, you know, if I may ask, you know, one thing that always is interesting to me is, how did you arrive in the field of disability rights? What is your connection to that?
Oh, in my case, I became interested in the issues because I've had a disability since birth.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay, Morgan, introduce yourself as well.
Absolutely. So I am a lawyer at a firm here in Ottawa called Raven Law, which specializes in employment, labor, and human rights law.
Mm-hmm.
And I, in the context of those areas, focus specifically on disability issues and disability rights work.
And you are the one of the reasons I've asked both of you to be on the show is that you are going to be doing an event in Illinois coming up here in a few weeks, correct?
Yeah, I'll be speaking April 19th at noon at the Disability Health and Social Policy Building at the UIC campus, 1640 West Roosevelt Road in Chicago. It's the first floor auditorium, so that's April 19th at noon at 1640 West Roosevelt Road.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the work that you're doing, and we'll come back to that information about the actual location and time and so forth, so that people have a chance to jot that down if they're listening and want to think about attending that event. So tell us about your book. Tell us about the work that you've done.
Okay, well, I could begin. Basically, one day I was reading a book called Rights of Inclusion by Munger and Engel, who are two prominent legal scholars, and they looked at the relationship between law and identity for a number of Americans with disabilities. And what was fascinating about this book is these were all individuals with various impairments, but none had actually filed an ADA case. None of them had been litigants. But what was interesting about this is that the very existence of the ADA shaped how they thought about themselves as people with disabilities. So in some cases, they embraced, you know, what we call a social model identity, or they saw their concerns as being about rights, and the fact that they didn't themselves litigate nevertheless did not impact on the fact that the legislation shaped how they saw themselves. So I thought that was a really interesting, groundbreaking study, and I wanted to replicate that in Canada. And so I went out, got myself a grant, and Morgan was a student of mine at the time, and I asked her. I wanted to have another voice, particularly a feminist perspective, and so the two of us set out to work on the data, and then after a long time, we ended up with our own smaller study. We had far fewer participants, but essentially we had 12 mostly young adults with physical disabilities that are Canadian, and we were able to share their stories of barriers in areas like transportation, employment, gender, and that in a nutshell is how it came about.
And so the 12 participants that you interviewed for this, were they similar to the two people that you had met earlier, that they had not litigated anything related to disability rights?
That's actually... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it was actually very similar in some ways in that most of these individuals had never been involved in a formal legal process. But one of the things that became fascinating as we were going through the data and ultimately became one of the major themes that we explore in the book is how, despite the fact that none of these individuals engaged in formal advocacy or formal rights cases, they were all involved in informal advocacy in some way throughout their lives, whether it was on behalf of other individuals with disabilities or on behalf of themselves. And so one of the things we really explore in the book is how those informal advocacy roles shape an individual's identity too, and how they inform how that individual sees themselves, both in relation to future advocacy efforts and to their own identity as a person with a disability.
So can you give some examples of what those informal advocacy efforts would look like?
Sure. I mean, it could be something as simple as one of the individuals that we spoke with had a lot of difficulty getting accommodation in her school. And so she was an individual who had to use a wheelchair at some times, but didn't have to all the time. But she required, for the most part, classrooms on a lower floor, and sometimes those couldn't be provided, and she would have to use an elevator to go up the stairs. But her school, in the course of these advocacy efforts, actually required her to demonstrate that she would be able to climb the stairs up and down to go to all of her classes in order to establish that, you know, she was somehow safe in order to attend classes on higher level floors. So these are the kinds of things that the participants spoke about in terms of informal advocacy efforts, these attempts to fight back both to get the accommodations they need and to deal with these sort of strange and unwieldy and inappropriate requests to prove themselves as individuals with disabilities.
Ravi, do you have anything you want to add there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that particular story is probably one of the most poignant. What I thought was really remarkable is that it not only is it invasive and degrading and humiliating, you know, for a teenage girl to have to prove this business, but they conducted a test that was not even accurate, because the test they conducted would have her go up and then come immediately back down the stairs. And in real life, she would actually have at least an hour or 2 hours of classes on the upper floor. So they created a test that was actually more difficult than the actual conditions in real life. And I thought that was particularly ironic.
That is pretty ironic, actually. So you guys are in Canada. Does Canada have a law similar to the Americans with Disabilities Act then?
Do you want me to answer that?
Well, I mean, I think I'll let Ravi deal with the comparative part because he's more familiar with that. But we do have laws here in Canada that deal with, broadly speaking, a requirement not to discriminate on the basis of disability and to provide accommodation up to the point of undue hardship. I think one of the things that was really striking in terms of why we wanted to do this study again in the Canadian context is that, unlike in the United States, where the Americans with Disabilities Act was sort of a prominent, it was an explosive moment in disability rights in many ways to suddenly have this piece of legislation that dealt with these issues. Whereas in Canada, the move towards that kind of recognition has been more gradual and has been more about amending human rights legislation that's already in place to include this concept within it.
Yeah, I mean, just to clarify a couple of things. So there's a few different things going on. In the early 80s, general human rights legislation was amended in the various provinces to include what was then called handicap, now disability, as a ground of discrimination. So certainly it's prohibited, but it's entirely dependent on individual complaints. It's not really akin to ADA-style legislation. There are suited provinces, like states, particularly Ontario, that have ADA-style legislation. So Ontario only started in 2005, and they've decided to put regulations on a phased-in basis up to 2025. So it's a work in progress. And most provinces don't have legislation at all at the provincial level. So that's an ongoing battle to have. We don't actually have legislation identical or analogous to the ADA. And so the human rights system does exist, but it takes typically a long time. It requires a lot of energy for individuals to complain. So I wouldn't characterize it exactly the same way.
So what is the hope that you have for the impact that this work will have on the disability community in Canada and around the world? Obviously, they're interested enough in Chicago to bring you to talk about the work. And so what are your hopes there?
Well, I think that the more we have the voices of people with disabilities, and if there's time on this broadcast, I actually have an extract that I can read. I think it's the story.
I'd love to hear that, yes.
Yeah, I think the stories are powerful to hear people with disabilities talk in their own voices, and they don't fall into any one category. Some loved battling against inaccessibility. It made them feel more alive. They found it fun. For others, they were exhausting processes. There's no one correct way to live your life with a disability. There's no one way to be an advocate. And so, you know, it's easier, I think, to have certain impairments and to embrace a disability identity. Others, you know, I think were some people in our, one person, I think, had a facial disfigurement. And so for her, it was harder to come to terms, you know, with disability identity. People react differently. But if you're speaking about our participant, Lisa, I do have this quotation if you're interested, just about her battle with her school board.
Absolutely. Go for it.
Okay, so this is at page 66 of our book. We quote Lisa. This is her code name. And when the principal, vice principal, and school board physiotherapist insisted she had to prove she had the ability to walk safely on stairs before she was allowed to participate. So here's the quote. My parents were there, and my dad kept saying to me, "Let me support your hips. Let me do this." And I said, "No, because if you touch me and if you let me use you as support, they're going to see that as sufficient reason to not allow me to do this if I need to. Yeah, it breaks your heart because you're my father and you don't want to see me stumble on a flight of stairs. But this could be the difference between me getting the credits I need to graduate or not. So just, unless I start falling, just please, I have to do this. It's going to hurt and I'm going to feel it for days, but I need to prove to them that I'm not unable." So I just think it's a powerful quotation. It really communicates her feelings about her situation in a way as scholars we never could.
What other kinds of unusual, was there anything unusual that came from this work, that stories that surprised you?
Well, I think one of the things that was very interesting to us as being sort of inclined to be to support the idea of inclusive education generally and inclusiveness across the board in all areas of society was how much many of the participants were in favor of the idea of segregated summer camps, which was very interesting to us. There's an entire section on it in the book, actually, because it was a concept that came up more than once in the conversations, and it tied in a lot to this idea of being exhausted by always advocating on behalf of yourself that Ravi was alluding to, that a lot of these individuals who were really staunch advocates for inclusion and for not being cut out of society in every other part of their life nonetheless found the idea of going to a segregated summer camp where they were surrounded only by individuals with disabilities and where they could just kind of be free and open and accepted as a person with disability in a community of individuals with disabilities was actually kind of a relief as compared to the rest of their lives where, you know, in one form or another, they were often being asked to either argue for accommodation measures or prove that they were an individual with a disability on a day-to-day basis.
Well, you know, it is vacation after all, right?
<laughs> <laughs> How
about you, Ravi? Do you have anything that sticks out for you?
I think that really covered it well. I mean, the summer camp, because, you know, we come into this as social model rights advocates when we hear people are saying, oh, they really love this segregated experience, and it sort of raises alarm bells. But when you get to hear why and you know, what the camp contributed, you know, it really is something that I think is fascinating, and I'd love to see more people do scholarship. I think there's a crying need for somebody in both countries to do a monograph, a disability studies monographs on summer camps on their own, because I know that in other contexts they've been controversial. I know that that there's certain disability organizations in the United States that have prohibited their own campers with disabilities from working there as volunteers, and so, you know, that's been litigated in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that there's a crying need for scholarship on that one small issue. But when you do this kind of interview data, qualitative research, it raises so many questions that you didn't start out thinking about. It brings you in unexpected directions.
Absolutely. And you know, it's true that if you are a real believer in community inclusion and accessibility, then you should have access to other people with disabilities as much as people who don't have them, right?
Certainly.
So, again, let's give the... So are you obviously have finished your book. You're going to be doing this presentation on it. What are you thinking as far as the next project? Because as one thing I know about disability rights advocates is they never rest.
In terms of future work, I mean, there are so many things that are on the go. I have another project which I'm doing in honor of my late colleague, Marta Russell. And she recently passed away in the United States, and we had co-written a piece years ago. And I'm coming out with an anthology in honor of her. So I'm doing that in the fall. But I'm constantly looking for ways to think about, you know, ways I can include the voices of people with disabilities. It takes a lot of time to do this sort of interview research.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to have to think about this for a while. That's a sort of a different project, an anthology. You can get other people to write it, you know, produce an edited collection. But I think it's going to be a while before I get back into doing interview data.
And I will be sure and put the information on the website, the Facebook page. This will be recorded so people can tune in later on and listen to it. I thank you so much for your participation today. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week. And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Before we get started with the next program, Rootstock Radio, let me give you the art theater listing for this week. Screening daily and starring William Dafoe as Vincent Van Gogh is At Eternity's Gate. The film is a journey inside the world and mind of a person who created some of the world's most beloved and stunning works of art. This is not a forensic biography, but some scenes based on Van Gogh's letters and common agreement about events in his life that present as facts, hearsay, and invention. Also screening daily is Maria by Callas, the first film to tell the life story of the legendary Greek-American opera singer in her own words, told through performances, TV interviews, home movies, family photographs, private letters, and unpublished memoirs. The film reveals an extraordinary woman who rose from humble beginnings in New York City to become an international superstar and one of the greatest artists of all time. Screening on Thursday, January 10th, is The Clove Hitch Killer. Boy Scout Tyler Burnside is a volunteer at his local church and the son of a community leader dad played by Dylan McDermott. One thing troubles the